Our reflection this morning is To Risk by that perennial favorite, Anonymous.
To laugh is to risk appearing the fool.
To weep is to risk appearing sentimental.
To reach out for another is to risk exposing our true self.
To place our ideas, our dreams before the crowd is to risk loss.
To love is to risk not being loved in return.
To hope is to risk despair.
To try is to risk failure.
To live is to risk dying.
I read a lot of books when I was young. I started with fairy tales and historical fiction, and then I found my way to Greek and Roman mythology. My mother had kept some of her poetry textbooks from college, so I made my way through them, hungry to soak up these views of the world. That's where I discovered a poem called Ode on a Grecian Urn by John Keats. I read it, and I enjoyed the pictures he painted with his words, but I didn't really have any context for the scenes he described. Most of the poem drifted through my imagination and floated away like clouds, except for the last lines. Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all you need to know. A seed was planted. A connection had been made. Later, I discovered that Emily Dickinson had also associated truth with beauty. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. An eye for truth, the two are one. We brethren are, he said. Truth and beauty in Emily Dickinson. I wanted beauty in my life. I was a dreamy child, the oldest of five girls, and somewhat isolated since the younger ones tended to pair off without me. We moved every year while my father was building his career, so I didn't have any long-term friendships. But I was always interested in art. I loved to look at beautiful pictures in my books or Disney princesses in the movies. As I grew older, I began to spend more time alone in my room, sewing, making paper crafts, and reading. My dream world was somewhat disconnected from the rest of the family. Some of you may have lived this way in 2020, when we were all isolated from one another. In my teen years, I developed some skill at drawing. I spent my idle time in classes drawing pictures in the margins, ladies in long, swirling dresses and beautiful flowers, instead of taking notes. I thrived in my art classes, though, throughout high school and into college. My art teachers often asked us a question: what makes it art? We had lively discussions, but I couldn't come up with an answer. I tucked that question away in my mind, next to truth and beauty. Another question I heard sometimes and wasn't able to answer was this: are you an artist? I might be at a sidewalk show with some of my paintings or sketching in a book in the park, and a curious stranger would ask me, are you an artist? I usually mumbled, not really, but I want to be someday. You see, I thought that to be an artist, you had to be a professional artist, creating work that was good enough to sell or display in a museum. I thought if I stayed with it and took all the college classes, then I would be an artist eventually. My path toward becoming an artist was rerouted in college. I expected that I would just get better and better at drawing, eventually learning to add color and depth until I could paint like the French Impressionists, or at least be an illustrator like Norman Rockwell or Tasha Tudor. But this was the 1970s. In one of the required courses, design, I came up against a language I didn't understand. Oh yes, I knew about symmetry and asymmetry. My mother had introduced me to Japanese flower arranging years before. But that type of design was beautiful to me. This abstract, hard-edged modernist style was alien, and I struggled to find any beauty in it. I began to doubt my own abilities. We entry-level art students were encouraged to visit and study the senior students' final projects, which were worlds beyond what I felt capable of. Meanwhile, my mother, who had always encouraged my artistic activities in childhood, was saying, "Oh, honey, artists never make any money." At the end of the semester, I received a C in that design class. That was the moment when I decided that I was not an artist and I couldn't become one. I looked around for a practical field that I could, where I could still be somewhat creative. I eventually found mass communications, changed my major. Finally finished college. The ups and downs of my early career are a long story and not really relevant to our today's topic, truth and beauty, except to say I was not living as my true self. At times, I was exploring my artistic side. I learned about typography, page layout, and copywriting. I was able to sell my promotional concepts with thumbnail sketches, and I often heard from our art director or from the account reps that I was really good. I worked side by side with artists, designers, and art directors. These were people who were actually making money using their art training, but I had given up on the idea that I too could be an artist. Eventually, I reached a point in my writing and desktop publishing career where I could choose to leave it behind. I was at home with a young child at that point, and Jay's career was enough to support all of us. I rediscovered my joy in creating through gardening, art classes, and hours of sewing. Eventually, it all clicked, and I created a small business, which I still have and create in today. I was excited and nervous when I ordered my first business cards. I was now a designer. I felt a bit of imposter syndrome. Imagine calling myself a designer. That was a kind of artist. But I added it to the cards. My business, making historical clothing, began to connect me with kindred spirits in Oregon and across the country. I no longer felt so isolated. I began to trust my own ability to create. Visiting art museums had always been a way that I replenished my soul. And it became even more fun once I stopped judging myself. I stopped comparing my abilities to those of the artists on display. And I began to appreciate the artist's vision, the brush strokes, and even the quality of the paint. I began to truly connect with these artists on a trip to Paris. I was there with a group from my daughter's school. On one of our free days, I chose to visit the Musée d'Orsay alone. It's a beautiful building. It's a former train station that now houses a wonderful collection of Impressionist art. I gave myself the time and space to explore the galleries. I especially wanted to visit the room where Monet's paintings were exhibited, hoping to see his paintings that touched me so deeply. In that room, I felt the peace of the open air, the sunlight, and the moving light. I could walk close to a painting and see the soft, feathery brush strokes, and then step back and bring the scene into focus. I also began to realize that Monet had perhaps been a rather fussy and fastidious artist in his old age. He painted haystacks, the same haystack, in different light throughout the day as the light changed. There was a wall of haystacks, all in different color combinations. Also in that gallery, I met a new artist, new to me, Albert Sisley. He was a contemporary and a friend of Monet's and Renoir and the other Impressionist painters. I had never studied his art before because he didn't have figures in it, and I was always interested in the ladies in the pretty dresses. But I was taken by his landscape paintings. They seemed to breathe with sunlight. I could almost hear the bees buzzing. He was one of the lifelong Impressionist painters. He was devoted to painting on plein air, outdoors. His personality seemed to move through every painting, every canvas, bringing the French countryside and woods to life. Those two long-ago artists in that gallery connected with me and brought me a feeling of warmth and peace. The atmosphere in the next room was very different. Here I was suddenly surrounded by bold colors and nervous energy. This was an exhibit of paintings by Vincent van Gogh. I do know he would have pronounced his name differently, something like Van Gogh, but I will use the pronunciation I learned in school. It's easier for my American accent. I did spend some time in that gallery, taking in those edgy brushstrokes and the force of his emotions. His personality pushed through the canvases, jangling me and bringing me into his worldview. Pretty soon, though, I left that disquiet behind and went into the next gallery, where I met Toulouse-Lautrec. He's bold, challenging, and playful. I went through several galleries in that museum that day, and by the time I sat down in the museum cafe for lunch, I had all these artists' personalities sitting alongside me. So what about you? Can you be touched by an artist who lived long ago? And can we now answer the question, what makes it art? My museum experience taught me to experience art through the connection I felt to the artist. If they were able to communicate an emotion through their work, and if you or me are able to receive it, then the connection is made. Art has happened. All right, another example. You are probably familiar with the painting called The Scream by Edvard Munch. The Scream is Munch's most famous work and one of the most recognizable paintings in all art history. A man stands wide-eyed on a bridge, holding his head in his hands as his mouth opens in a devastating scream. Even when this image is parodied or printed on a t-shirt, its power remains. Munch painted it in 1893, with other versions following. It has been widely interpreted as representing the universal anxiety of modern man. But it actually was a very personal statement for Munch. With this painting, Munch met his stated goal as an artist of the study of the soul, that is to say, the study of my own self. Munch's mother had died of tuberculosis, and he and his three siblings were raised by his very religious father, who told ghost stories to his young children at bedtime. They read Edgar Allan Poe in his home. Edvard Munch feared that he would succumb to the family tendency toward mental illness. At the time of this painting, the adult Munch had just visited his sister in a mental institution. Munch wrote of how the painting came to be. "I was walking down the road with two friends when the sun set. Suddenly the sky turned as red as blood. I stopped and leaned against the fence, feeling unspeakably tired. Tongues of fire and blood stretched over the bluish-black fjord. My friends went on walking, while I lagged behind, shivering with fear. Then I heard the enormous, infinite scream of nature." That painting touches us. Even without knowing the story of how it came to be, a human viewer can understand the feeling of isolation and sudden terror it shows. I can now answer my art teacher's question, what makes it art? In my understanding, it is art if it communicates the artist's emotion to the viewer. Definitely in Munch's case, and really true of all the paintings I have talked about, whether it's Monet's dappled light and fussy brushstrokes, Sisley's airy approach to nature, Van Gogh's tormented, swirling colors, Munch's frightened scream, and so many more. Not every artist will connect with every viewer. For example, Andy Warhol's soup cans don't stir much emotion in me, but maybe you respond to their ironic playfulness. There are many kinds of artists, not just from the world of painting, but other disciplines too. Even with my limited musical training, I am moved by classical composers like Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, and many more. George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue always makes me stop in my tracks and then lets my spirit soar. Kevin's beautiful music this morning connected us with composers who have inspired him. Writers have touched us. Shakespeare with his sonnets, Henry David Thoreau in his explorations of how to live deliberately, Benjamin Franklin in his thoughtful, witty reflections, or Mark Twain throughout all of his works. Twain seems to be the universal outsider, looking at humans and their foibles, and yet connecting with us, making us kindred spirits. Jane Austen is another keen observer of human nature. The 20th century has brought us so many more authors expressing powerful emotions, exposing injustice, and connecting to us through their stories. They live on through their works. The poet John Keats connected with me through his poem, Ode on a Grecian Urn. He was 23 when he wrote that in 1819, after visiting the British Museum with a friend and viewing the collection of Greek antiquities. He was touched by the unknown artist who had carved images of people and processions into those marble urns thousands of years before. He wrote a mysterious poem about his questions. Who were the people on the urns? Men or gods? What were they doing? Where were they going? And his reflections, imagining that the young lover reaching for the maiden was blessed to never grow old, but also doomed never to kiss her. John Keats himself would die 2 years later. But his words lived on, inspiring Emily Dickinson and later my teenaged self. His words, comparing truth and beauty, became part of my own worldview. From unknown artists thousands of years before in ancient Greece, Keats crafted images and words that would live on, connecting them with my young self. I took his ideas and made them part of my pursuit of art. Today, I pass them along to you. Here's another question. Does someone need to be famous to be an artist? I have chosen these examples because they were famous, and I was fairly sure that everyone would know what I was talking about. But no, our world is full of people whose names I will never know, but who have left it more beautiful. For example, there are rhododendrons and azaleas at my house that must be 70 or 80 years old. They are growing on the north side, and they are happy and healthy. Every spring they bloom for me, making me grateful. And yet I do not know who planted them. She was an artist. There is a park in Hillsboro, Roodbridge Park. It inspires me whenever I visit. The landscape combines flowing water, stone bridges, hilly lawns, and tall native trees in an idyllic setting. It feels almost like a scene from one of my childhood books. I don't know who designed it, probably a landscape team, but they have created a work of art. You may know of a place where you like to walk or meditate or just eat your lunch in peace. Someone probably planned that space and left it for you to enjoy. We all enjoy nursery rhymes and folk songs written by Anonymous. Anonymous was an artist too. And whenever I look around at our beautiful church building, I appreciate the unknown architect and builders who helped create it in 1911. The soaring roof, the solid scissors truss design, and the textured walls all create a place that feels inviting, spiritual, and safe. When we are here, we are connected to the early citizens of the town of Orenco, those Scottish Presbyterians and Hungarian Methodists who shared the building in its early days. I realize now that I am an artist. I see the world through an artist's eyes, appreciating the pieces and places that I love and making a few of my own along the way. Over the years, I have created hundreds of garments, presented dozens of historical events, planted a few gardens, and sometimes made a poem or a little painting. My traditional creations reflect my own truth, sharing values that are important to me. Some of my creations have connected with others, sharing my personality and my sense of the world. Creation is a spiritual act, one we are all capable of. Your medium may be different than mine. Your story will be your own. Your art may be a delicious recipe, a new verse that you wrote for an old song, a bedtime story you tell your children, your flower garden, a hiking trail that you helped to build, or a new system you created at work. Even when you are no longer there, your creation will live on, connecting with your friends and family and people yet to come. Each of us is an artist. You are a creator. I think of the phrase namaste. I have heard it often at the conclusion of yoga classes, where we define it as the divine in me greets the divine in you. And since creation is a truly divine act, we could think of it as namaste. The creator in me greets the creator in you. You may think that you are not an artist. I have heard people say, I don't have a creative bone in my body. But I believe each of us has a truth inside that we find beautiful. Your energy may be bold or flowing, quiet or energetic. Let yourself be open to your truth. What inspired you as a child? What beautiful pictures are burned into your brain? What poems stay with you and pop up in moments of quiet? What do you know or do that makes your heart sing? That is your truth. You can share it with your world in your own unique way. Who knows what you will create? It will grow from your own truth, and it will be beautiful. Namaste.